In the myriadic year of our Lord, the 10,000th year of the King Undying, the kindly Prince of Death, Gideon Nav packed her sword, her shoes, and her dirty magazines, and she escaped from the House of the Ninth. She didn't run. Gideon never ran, unless she had to. In the absolute darkness before dawn, she brushed her teeth without concern and splashed her face with water, and even went so far as to sweep the dust off the floor of her cell. She shook out her big black church robe and hung it on the hook. Having done this every day for over a decade, she no longer needed light to do it by. This late in the equinox, no light would make it here for months. In any case, you could tell the seasons by how hard the heating vents were creaking. She dressed herself from head to toe in polymer and synthetic weave. She combed her hair. Then Gideon whistled through her teeth as she unlocked her security cuff and arranged it and its stolen key considerately on her pillow. Like a chocolate in a fancy hotel. Leaving her cell and swinging her pack over one shoulder, she took the time to walk down five flights to her mother's nameless catacomb niche. This was pure sentiment, as her mother hadn't been there since Gideon was little and would never go back in it now. Then came the long hike, up 22 flights the back way, not one light relieving the greasy dark, heading to the split-off shaft and the pit where her ride would arrive. The shuttle was due in 2 hours. You're listening to Nun Pod with Left Grief, Episode 1, Chattel.
I'm Claire Beans, and I am a Locked Tomb fan. I have been a cosplayer as a Locked Tomb fan. I have been adjacent to fanfic writers and reading some of my friends' works. I've been adjacent to archivist type fans and learning from their projects. And I've seen a lot of really cool creative stuff. And part of that is looking at the roots of Tasmamir as an author. I also find super interesting as a fan, and so I like the deep dives into her work as well. I'm more of the cosplayer type of fan. I love the aesthetic details that are as part of her world building, and I love connecting with those as a way of understanding the character in the world and using that as inspiration in my art. Also, like really sick playlists. That's me as a Locktomb fan.
I'm Han. I have been in the fandom for probably 5 years. Also, really heavy cosplay and costuming. Also, playlists. Also, like deep textual analysis. I have a TikTok series that's moving through the books from the first end papers on that's just looking at illusions and currently, I've been on the dramatis personae for a year and a half.
I haven't even seen that yet, so
Oh my
like
God, you should.
I know, I'm just like, shit, that's gonna be great. We'll talk about it next time.
I just did the second and the third house. You would love it. Also, I figured out what's happening with like Laminae. Very proud of that. It took a long time. I spent a
Possible future cosplay goals.
Oh, you should. You should. You should.
We should. We have read this book many times. If our fandom description of ourselves wasn't implicit of that. We want to reread the book and reflect on it now, having had all of this, 4 years of experience, relationship with this book and this series and its fans, and people who aren't its fans that we turn into its fans.
We are recording during Electo pause, so we have no information on Electo, but we are not going to avoid spoilers through Nona.
Oh, and one more thing. We're hoping to connect with other people that we've connected with about this series along the way in the show. So, noting that there are so many different chapters and so many different moments, as well as the supplementary material, if you would love to come and talk about your fan relationship with these books and shout at us for sharing the book with you, or share art that we've connected over, there's a specific spot that you want to participate in. Let us know, and then we can book you into that spot because we want everyone in their excitement.
So chapter one.
Chapter one.
This is about a 2 hour period. We know that it is sometime during the fall or spring equinox. We're on the ninth, and it is early, early morning. And we see Gideon preparing to escape the ninth. And we know that this is her 86th escape attempt.
And they began when she was four.
When she was four, yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me in this rereading of chapter one was the conflict around Gideon's status, because Gideon is repeatedly asserting a difference between being indentured and being a slave. But the two interlocutors that we see in this chapter, Crux and Iglamine, respond to that differently. So Iglamine is like, yes, you are indentured and not a slave. And Crux is like, fuck you are chattel. We definitely see alignment between Crux and Iglamine that, like, whatever you are, it means you're going to serve until you die and then afterwards.
Iglamine is a liberal.
Yeah. The distinction matters a lot to Gideon, which means, like, that tells me, kind of as a sociologist, there are slaves, that this distinction is maybe legally meaningful, but maybe not socially meaningful, and maybe not materially, like, economically meaningful.
Yeah, because it like Gideon has enough, independent agency to be able to apply to the cohort.
Yeah, she
There
knows
are
that
no
she has the right to apply to the cohort.
has the right to apply to the cohort, has the right e acknowledging as an indentured servant to this household that legally is not a barrier. It's really clear that like Eglemini recognizes that that exists, honors that it is important to Gideon, but neither Crux nor Eglemini have any like faith that that is real or functional in any way whatsoever. Like Eglemini sees Gideon's potential, gives them space to grow. Like Eglemini, I think if that path was available to Gideon, Eglemini would want that for Gideon.
But Crux just, like, literally doesn't care. He seems very concerned with, like, what the house owns, and he's like, we own you. You are one of the things that we own.
It's also very important to him for Gideon to submit. Like, he takes a lot of time to make sure Gideon really understands how much he hates her.
I honestly, that reminded me a lot of W.E.B. Du Bois talking about, like, rituals of humiliation and submission as characterizing, like, the Jim Crow South in the United States, that, like, part of how social power is created is through these ritualized social interactions where somebody gets to assert the low status of the other person and the other person has to reflect that low status back. And Gideon is marked by this refusal to do that. She's just like, no, this status does not define me. I'm not playing this bullshit. I'm getting out of here. One of my, like, hills that I die on is that the Locke Tomb series is intentionally exploring Mbembe's theory of necropolitics. I think the fact that the ninth is an agricultural colony and a prison is so important. It felt like such an important thing, especially to establish in chapter one, and then to kind of not go back to. Like, we don't go to the prison. And one of the only things that we know about the prison, other than it's in this bubble installation, is that Gideon believes that living conditions for prisoners are better than her conditions. I think she's very likely wrong about that, because it sounds like the ninth prison is like space Alcatraz. But she thinks that their lives are better.
Which, as a teenager, this would have been a thing that she probably would have, moaned at Eglemini or Crux about this belief, and they have not found any reason to put any effort into correcting it.
Well, and we know that she gets a lot of her information from magazines and print media that is aligned with the colonial imperial structure. And so it would make sense that there are narratives about what prisons are and are like and do that, like, reflect the sort of colonial propaganda.
Totally. I know your necropolitics probably have touched on this, like the idea that it is fine to pull someone back from the dead for whatever fucking reason is a shift in terms of our relationship to the sacredness of the dead. In a like for that to be a commonplace thing to have like professionals in that aspect in such a remote place or specialists in that place. That there are specialists, like that implies some necropolitics there as well.
Yeah, 100%. One of the like really big core ideas of necropolitics and why it's so applicable to necromancy as we see it in the Locked Tomb series is the idea of instrumentalizing the body and turning the body into a thing. A necropolitical situation is a situation that puts people in a position to be abandoned, to be allowed to die or made to die, and where they are reduced to objects. And so, like, slavery is a paradigmatic necropolitical situation. And so, like, we see our first POV character is a slave, even though she's nominally not a slave. We see in this first chapter she is a slave. And she's in the context of the colony, which is one of the big necropolitical situations, and she's adjacent to a prison, which is the other. And so, like, the main ideas are like the slave colony and the prison colony are the main sites of necropolitical in the real world.
I'm reminded that Tasmania is a Kiwi, and being from New Zealand, Australia has a large presence as well, and they share some interesting history elements. And so I think the idea of an agricultural and prison, honestly, like not very well designed agricultural colony and but a very much more engineered prison colony being like the kind of two different contrasting notes, like mirror as many things that I've heard written about her really like carries a lot of clear themes through her writing, through her life. I like to reference the Homestuck fandom, but like where she grew up and what was influenced by and the identity of place that she learned and navigated, like there's some interesting parallels there.
I think that the point you made about the contrast between the high-tech prison colony and low-tech agricultural colony also is really echoed in other ways that we see technology used in Dreerbrer. Like, Gideon has this high-tech security cuff, but the snow leeks are being grown with hoes. I was noticing materials a lot in this reread. I did one reread, I think, at your house, actually. I think during the like 3 week stay that I was with you, I did a reread that was 100% oriented to textiles and materials, and so that's something that stands out to me a lot. And so, like, she's wearing polymer and synthetic, and she has a plastic bag, which is interesting
Yeah, and
because
it's a plastic bag that seems to be a throwaway
I
level
know,
of like it doesn't have any robustness in the description.
yeah, it's like a it's
Like I saw sandwich
like
bag.
a squeezy pouch.
Sure,
It's porridge, so it's probably not a sandwich bag.
Okay, whatever. I put porridge in a sandwich bag, but
But I noticed that she also wears steel-toe boots, so the rigid toe of her boot is not a synthetic, which is interesting.
So to me, the thought that immediately explained this was, okay, so we have done absolutely nothing in terms of changing our industrial standards and expectations from wherever the origins of this was, and it has common origins to our world right now. It's using the language of materials that we are familiar with in assemblies that we are familiar with. So there's these things that say that having continued doing all things the same went this direction. And this direction like implies, you know, this expansive space empire. We've already kind of established that there's this expansive space empire. And so we have certain industrial standards that we just continued, and that's fine. So that would imply like having to go to other planets to continue to find materials, which would make sense, and in a larger space empire. And like exactly what the details around how that came to be true is not talked about in this book at all, really.
No, and
But it's
definitely,
implied in this in the room.
yeah, even from the very beginning, because like you see the skeletons farming, but there's no hint at like plastics manufacture. Like, where is this plastic bag coming from?
The idea that the systems that we currently are seeing happen right now from textile materials to economic structures and colonialism and like echoes of religious practices too. Like there's all these things that it's like what they had was preserved in time for thousands of years unchanged. That blows my
Keep doing
fucking mind.
prisons for 10,000 years.
That always, like, every time, like, kind of like the amount of control required to do that. Like, you're having to isolate populations by planets. You're having to, what I understand is, manufacture a war.
I think that they have to manufacture war as a resource allocation strategy,
Yeah.
first of all, because that's how empire works.
That's how important.
But also because we don't see critical manufacture happening anywhere in
Yeah.
the houses.
Yeah, absolutely. So there has to be, like, to me, it implies places like that in Nona.
Yeah, exactly.
That is out of the Empire House story, and they're the thing that makes the story materially continue to exist.
Right. Because like houses like the second house, like the third house, like the fourth house, like the fifth house, like these houses, the idea of having a house that's all about luxury, that's all about the military, that's all about the academy, they have to be materially supported somehow. And you don't see that in any of these characters' perspectives about what living on their house is like. And Gerber is a little bit of an exception because they at least fucking grow food. But the nine houses are not living on snow leaks. Like, there is a lot of unanswered material production that we're not seeing, and that is happening somewhere. And I think, like you said, it's happening on New Row. It's happening in the outlying parasitized planets.
A shuttle implies a certain level of regular travel between these places.
Yeah, and we would need that because of the goods.
Yeah, and like looking at where Gideon is, that may just be a resource transfer shuttle. Like that may not actually be about people at all.
But we know that the ninth used to have pilgrims.
Right. Okay. So that's certainly that's and that has a whole industry that responds to it as well. So that agricultural
There
colony
might be
thing.
hotels for that.
Hotels. There we go. There's our hotel.
There might at least used to have been a hotel, although I don't know, maybe there's
So
maybe.
imagining Djerba as like an abandoned tourist town is fucking wild. I need a second to digest that because now I want to pull up religious pilgrimage towns and places and like what industry looks like there, but also like right beside
I
my
literally
mom.
just searched Kutnahora tourism because like Bone Church.
Yeah, okay, I know the place. It's like a cathedral made of bones in an incredibly intentional, artful way. The like the most ossuary of ossuaries.
Yeah, it's extremely ninth vibes.
Extremely.
But so Kutnahora is also just like a small town. But people have been going to the Sedlak ossuary since the early 18th century.
When was it built?
The town was built in the 13th century because it was just a mining town.
Okay.
And then the cathedral, I think, is early 18th century.
Yeah. So what that kind of sets me thinking about the number of people needed to, like, I would be curious about the range of dating the like. What is the widest range of dates and ages between those different skeletons? Because, like, how long did it take to build? Was that town able to sustain its need for you'd have to import a lot of skeletons or have community permission to raid hundreds of years of grave sites? Like, where are those bodies coming from that it makes sense culturally?
Also, who's running them? Like,
Yeah.
we know that outside the first, the skeletons are not autonomous. They are being puppeted. And I think the number of skilled necromancers we see on the ninth versus the number of skeletons is already a little weird. Assuming skeletons can do heavy manual labor already requires complete magical thinking, because a skeleton is very lightweight
Yeah,
and doesn't have any muscles.
and I guess in
So,
one way, this is our first glimpse of Thanergy and Thallergy. Like,
yeah.
this is our first glimpse of what magic applied looks like. And I'm trying to think of the next example, but that's the first one for a good while, because the security cuff is implied that it's tech, not necromancy. So, like, the next time we see necromancy, we're looking at maybe when we start to learn about Harrow's childhood.
Yeah, because I mean, most of the necromancy that we actually see is Harrow's necromancy, which we know is weird.
Harrow isn't the only necromancer in Gerber, though.
No. But both of her parents are dead, so they're not
Yes.
necromancing anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So that so
We know that Crux and Aglamine are non-necromantic.
yeah, and Harrow would be very accurate, very like precisely and regular. Well, I guess only puppeting her parents during public appearances. That's right. So it's minimal. Trying to think of like an education, you know, that a child would have where that might be something that she'd be involved with. But like, it seems so class distinct that like if you're a like an agricultural necromancer, would Harrow be expected to stoop so low as to be responsible for the skeletons hoeing the leeks?
It seems like no, because if the kind of royal family of Gerber had been playing a major structural role in the like day-to-day necromancy of Gerber, then the death of her parents would have been noticed.
Yeah,
If they
I.
were carrying the load of keeping Gerber's skeletons going,
Yeah.
then their death would be a lot harder to cover, because either Hera would have had to pick up the slack, which she probably could have.
Yeah.
But then when she left.
However she expresses it, I think one thing we can't criticize Harrow for is her like commitment to her custodianship of the knights. Like, she's like, I take this job very seriously. You may not understand how I do that, but very seriously. And so like I don't think she would have just abandoned them to agricultural ruin by leaving later on in the book. There's got to be other people who are responsible for that, which implies like just a class distinction in applications of necromancy.
It kind of seems like maybe that's a lot of what the nuns are up to. We know, obviously, that some of them are doing like medical necromancy because they fix hair. No, they fix
Lemonade.
Gideon and they fix Aglaemine. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of anything else about the nuns that would kind of refine that a little bit, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head, because it's like in the next chapter we probably will be talking about, no, maybe chapter three, but like the summons to muster. Like, you get a lot of this is the culture, this is the interplay dynamics.
But we don't actually know which members of Gerber are necromantic in general. There isn't a clear like cultural distinction. We only know that Aglaemine and Crux aren't necromancers, or it's suggested that they're not necromancers because necromancers act on them. But it could just be that they're not their own doctor. Like, you don't actually know.
We find this out later, but necromancy is a thing that someone is either adept at or not,
Yeah,
right? So
they're
it's like
born with
either
it.
and you can't fake it.
Well,
Someone is faking it for you.
yeah, it's hard to fake.
It's hard to fake. There are, you know, workarounds.
So
So
like we know, but even I guess it's rarely stated whether or not someone is or isn't. Like even with like
yeah, it's
Crux,
very
it's assumed that he isn't, but it's never actually stated.
yeah, and so that might either be a binary or a gradient in terms of capacity or skill. Like, Ordis may have, you know, attunement to Thanergy or what, however it might be referred to as they like identify this in people.
We also
Like,
kind of know that the rules are bullshit because John wasn't born with it. And so we know that for sure it is acquirable. And we know from conversations later between Harrow and Calamities that there's a skill gradient, like you said. And so I think like it's culturally binary, but it might not be as binary as.
And this fits into a lot of, you know, political representations of magic systems, in the sense that like there's a class-based centralization of power and the narrative of how to access power. And then at a certain point, as this world and story matures, it becomes obvious that this power is actually decentralized and accessible to everyone through education.
Yeah.
Like Star Wars did it. What was it? Dragon Prince? The one, it was, so there's like lots of, there's a few different examples I think that could be found of like this story told about power.
Well, and I think that that kind of reflects the influence of Foucault and the idea that power is not a binary that you have or don't have, but that power is widely distributed and you have access to different amounts of it in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that, I think, is that something that's wonderfully examined differently in each book. Okay, so we've got Gideon having these two confrontations. And after having these two confrontations, Gideon is almost feeling optimistic. We haven't had any consequences for, we haven't had any find out. We're still in the fuck around stage.
We know that she has found out every previous time, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That, like, she always gets caught, and when she gets caught, she gets tortured.
Knowing that, and Gideon continues to do this, it illustrates this kind of delusional confidence or resentful tenacity. Like, how do you, from early childhood, establish and maintain that mentality of, it's going to work this time?
Yeah.
It's interesting having this as, like, the our rawest, most un... like. We have not yet gone through all the new trauma. We just have the baseline trauma. This is our like unaltered Gideon, is this level of like, let's fucking do this, you know? Like,
yeah, I think this is the most kind of supernatural thing about her that we know so far, because from both kind of a sociology background and an ex-therapist background, that degree of confidence and optimism feels so improbable.
Yeah. And like, the thing that most simply explains it to me is just like spite, like as a teenager, spite.
I think also liberalism. She really believes in a sense of kind of fairness in the world. She thinks that she's personally getting fucked over because she is around bad people.
Yeah, not that, but the whole system has.
She thinks that the system is good, and if she can just get closer to the middle of the system, she's going to be okay.
And it's like so interesting, because this is the furthest from like Gideon started at the epicenter of the system. Gideon is from the epicenter of the system. This is the furthest that she'll ever be from the system.
Yeah.
Like to recognize that that like her drive to get closer into the center is also like the thing that like blinds her to, like, it's tragic.
I agree that, like, the core tragedy of the Gideon, and especially the Gideon to Kiriona storyline, is she thinks that the thing that's going to save her from the evil of the system is just getting closer to and higher up in the system. And I have to assume and hope that her resolution looks like realizing that that's not going to do it.
Yeah. And, like, have you ever read The Poppy Wars?
No. Is that the one with the war crimes?
It has so many war crimes.
Yeah, I think I got a synopsis of that and decided that it was not for me.
That's totally fair. I read through the whole trilogy. I really like the way they take the moral certainty that they kind of paint in the first book and start to make it a lot more nuanced. The thing that's relevant here is that the main character by the end has that realization of like, oh, I am so far into this and it has fucked me and destroyed me, and now I am the monster that I have lived my life terrified to become, and here is me self-destructing. There's this very, very delicious, satisfactory consequence that happens, and you're kind of with this character at the very end as she's basically burning up, like, just everything is on fire, and she's a kind of acknowledging that this is where it was always going to go. it was one of the most satisfying endings to a book that I've ever read. But like the war crimes were real hard. But yeah, I'm very fine with war crimes being behind a veil and the consequences being the thing that like lands as like, oh, for this to be possible, some horrible things have to be true.
I felt like that was such a pervasive theme of the Locked Tomb series up to Nona. It implies these horrible things that have to be happening. And before Nona came out, I wasn't even sure if it was intentional because I was like, am I reading into this because I'm a sociologist? Like, am I putting this into the text because I know that this is how the real world works? Or is the author putting into this text because she knows that this is how the real world works? And in Nona, she was like, hey guys, hey guys, hey guys, do you know this?
I love the way that Nona was written and the way it did that, but also the way that it like there's this thread that goes through while they are like trapped. All of our protagonists are essentially trapped in different ways. Each of them do a lot to change the course of where things will go and have it on their terms. They're like, okay, this is the scenario that I'm in. I am not powerless in it. Like, and this early on establishes that this is a core part of who Gideon is. And this occurs to her maybe at age 4, which is to me really interesting that a child raised in relative isolation. She like had peers until she was 2, but so had socialization. There was a community, there were other children, a substantial number of other children. Like 200 in a small community is a lot of kids. It's interesting enough to think of like given the other kind of older population that's seeming to be the dominant kind of demographic there, that there were so many children. Like that's honestly like its own question. There's almost this implication of like where did all the guardians go?
Yes.
Like, big question mark, where did everybody go? A handful of years ago. So it's as so I'm a early childhood development professional, and so to me, the idea Tasma Mirror's dedication to details is really thorough. I don't know what her interest in terms of early childhood development is, but the idea that someone's in their first 2 years in a rich, stimulating, abundant community, having their needs met, which generally across this book series, known as a different conversation, but see, people seem to be within the system having their day-to-day needs met, slaves included, is the kind of implication that I'm getting. After 2 years, there was only 3 children left.
So one of the things that I wanted to point out and ask you about as an early childhood professional is they raise their children communally.
It does seem so because it talks about a crèche at some point, I think.
Yeah, it establishes it here and then it gives the details later. All the children are physically together a lot.
Yeah, and like,
And she goes to the nursery with all 200 other children. But why is Ordis the only child who survived? Because if it was just that he had aged out, then he should have age peers.
yeah.
Also, it's like one of the things that I go back to is where there's an age, like as you mentioned, there's an age gap. Where are all of the like productive, the people who would have been the parents of all the kids who died in the crèche flu?
Yeah.
Because we don't have a bunch of people in their 30s and 40s.
So my first guess for that is that they also died. They are just not mentioned.
It seems like that would be like auto-genocidal. Because obviously, killing 200, like killing all of your children, an entire generation of your own children is already wild. But why would you also kill their parents?
So Harrow required a payment up front.
Right.
And the point was to ensure the continuity of the ninth by giving it continuity of leadership. So yeah, it wouldn't make sense because they explicitly are trying to continue the survival of the ninth.
Yeah. I had kind of assumed that there was like an unmentioned exodus, that like people who had maybe come from other houses and joined and then had kids on the ninth and then their kids died on the ninth were like, fuck this, I'm going back to the fourth. And we see that in Ordis's mom, but she couldn't leave because she was married to the House Cavalier. And so once her husband is dead, and her son is now going to be taken, she's like, fuck this, I'm out. But I kind of wonder if, like, other people, particularly who were immigrants to the ninth, were like, I am going home. This sucks.
So, oh, there's a, oh, my prison babies.
Prison babies.
Oh, yeah,
Maybe.
that is the simplest explanation,
Yikes.
proximity wise. Yeah, yikes. I think it would have to be an either or scenario, though. I don't think the ninth would mix those two groups of children together. I think their class difference would keep them separated, despite the
Oh
point.
yeah, well, I don't, well, because Gideon's in there.
Oh yeah, Gideon and Harold were schoolmates, right? Essentially.
Yeah, and Gideon and Ordis were both in the nursery.
Okay, so it could be both.
Could be both. I wonder how many of those babies were slave babies.
Yeah,
Because we also
because
don't hear anything else about other indentured servants on the ninth, but Gideon can't be the only indentured person.
yeah, especially given like Crux's and Eglemini's like really well-established attitude towards that position in the community.
Right. This is clearly a thing culturally.
Yeah, so like if one orphan baby is, you know, like that would make a lot of sense. Prison babies, indentured servants.
I wonder how big that prison is. How many people are there?
Ugh.
That's so gross. I'd never thought of that. And that's gross.
Yeah. Yeah, as soon as my brain did it, I was like, crap.
Yeah. There are big unanswered questions about the shape of the population in Dribber, and we don't get answers to them. Something real weird is happening.
Yeah. I think the only further piece of information we really get that might be applicable here is way later when John's like, here's a spaceship full of cryogenically frozen bodies. And there's some numbers involved in that scene that would be interesting in terms of like what was an acceptable, not that Harrow had a lot of agency in that particular moment, but like what was an acceptable negotiation for what she was here to do.
Yeah, like what John believed was a population infusion that would be sufficient to create stability.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have so many questions about what's happening with the population of Dribber. And
Totally. Yeah, we can come back to that. We should.
well, and I think it makes sense also that Gideon doesn't flag it because Gideon has literally never seen anyone else in her life. And
Yeah.
so that's not the kind of thing that would come up as an obvious contrast. Like, she could have learned about
Yeah.
hotel from the comic books, but she wouldn't learn about population stability.
And it also like if it's you know media that upholds the imperial narrative, it's also not going to be anything that really criticizes what's being done on the ninth. So like so it supports it being normal, and like she knows her situation sucks.
Yeah.
She knows there are better things, but she doesn't realize like what the implication of the reality of it is. Like she hasn't been given that.
Which I think, is a very normal late teens experience.
Yeah.
Understanding your bad situation largely in terms of personal morality and agency and not fully understanding systemic, I mean, not even maybe beginning to question
Yeah.
systemic or structural forces.
I think this is one of the reasons why young adult apocalyptic fiction is really satisfying to people of a wide age range, because it takes you through this learning experience in a very non-judgmental way, where it says like, yeah, you start out here not really understanding the system you're in, but then you identify as someone called to act in response to what you learn. And like that is a really satisfying way to learn, is to see someone else, you know, develop a relationship with their own sense of agency over their knowledge gaining, even when it sucks.
I think Tamsin Muir does such an amazing job of that because she gives us this character, and obviously some shit's weird, some stuff
Yeah.
sucks about the society because she's an indentured servant and maybe a slave.
Yeah.
Like, that's not good.
Yep.
But we, through Gideon's perspective, see the cohort and the army as this like liberatory possibility. And we're
Yeah.
like, hell yeah, the Empire. Let's do it. Let's be the best guy in Empire. And then, we meet Jean-Marie and we meet Isaac. And we're like, hold on, the Empire is doing what?
I was texting Han yesterday as we were kind of setting ourselves up for this. And like, I was just reading the Dramatis Personae and I was like, I just got to John Rhea's name and I'm like, I am already upset. Yeah, we'll get there. I'll get mad.
Yeah.
This is a really, really like teeny granular thing. Getting really into the close reading here. If the ninth, enigmatic, uncanny ninth, the house of the seventh, sown tongue, the anchorite's house, the house of heretical secrets, weird that they identify that way, was nonplussed at having an infant on their hands, they moved fast anyway.
This is in chapter one.
In chapter one, on the bottom of page 23, nonplussed is a contronym, and neither definition makes any sense. Because nonplussed can mean either surprised or confused, which is what it seems to mean. Like, that's what you'd assume that it means, because obviously Wake's arrival is very surprising. This is a surprising situation. And so it would make sense to be surprised at the presence of this baby. But we know from later context that the ninth is in a prolonged population crisis. So they wouldn't be surprised and confused to have a baby. They'd be delighted to have a baby. But nonplussed can also mean unperturbed or like apathetic, which is how they treat Gideon in general, but also wouldn't make sense for a group in a population crisis. And so nonplussed points in two opposite directions, neither of which work.
So sometimes I think Tasman Muir is like just feeling a little spicy and will throw something just to fuck with you.
I think that this is Gideon. I
So
think that they think.
this is a first person emotional perception of
Yeah.
this teenager's interpretation of why people would treat her this way.
Yeah, I think Gideon is telling us her story of what happened and how people reacted to her. There's no named characters in this story, which would make sense because she's a baby. She doesn't know who found her mom. She doesn't know anything about like who made these decisions. She is projecting an emotional experience onto them. And I think that her projection just doesn't make sense. Like it wouldn't make sense in cultural context. And I think this is just her supposition.
Yeah, 'cause it would both it would explain like both their cruelty towards her and their indifference. Like that those are two things that like, you know, being irritated by or being, you know, indifferent to. Like that I think I'm picking up what you're saying, right?
Yeah, but we only later learn in Harrow that they actually weren't indifferent towards her until later. And they were never really indifferent toward like that. She just was misinterpreting how people were responding to her the whole time.
We're going to be doing this kind of by chapter. We might lump it into bigger pieces, but if you want to follow along, the bar's low.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaylee, and edited by Han Kaylee. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.